Okay, thank you very much for coming today. We're going to have, after our keynote address, we're going to have the first panel of the day, which is focusing on an important and interesting topic, the domestic politics of the crisis. How does the crisis affect politics and political responses? So each of our speakers are going to speak for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then we'll open up the floor to questions and discussion. So starting us off is Dr. Jonathan Hopkins. He's a reader in comparative politics at the LSE. He studied French and Spanish, and after a year of lecturing, he joined the graduate program at the European University Institute in Florence, where his dissertation focused on the Spanish transition to democracy. Afterwards, he moved back to the UK, lectured at the University of Durham, and then the University of Birmingham, before joining the LSE in October 2004. He teaches courses on a range of very interesting topics, including comparative European politics, European integration, British politics, comparative political economy, and democratization. So we're pleased to welcome Dr. Jonathan Hopkins.
Thank you. Right. Thanks very much, Stephanie. And that's terrifying, the teaching load I've got, all those different courses. And I'm actually going to have to run out of this session early, before the end, because I'm teaching at noon. So apologies for that. Quickly to get started, because I don't want to overrun. This paper is basically a comparison of Spain and Italy, and the point of it is to find the reasons why, well, first of all, two countries with a lot of similarities but also a lot of differences can find themselves equally mired in difficulty in the middle of this euro crisis, but also to try and look at how institutional differences between them have led to the crisis taking a different form in these two countries. So this is what I'm exploring. It's not yet a completed paper, but these are the ideas that I'm working with, and I'd be interested to know what people think. So the euro crisis, and you know, my focus isn't on the euro crisis rather than financial crisis more broadly. The euro crisis is interesting for a number of reasons. One is that there is this clear kind of north-south divide in Europe that we've seen emerging within the Eurozone between credit-worthy northern countries revolving around Germany and kind of satellite economies, if you can call them that, and then the sort of southern periphery, which Ireland is often included in, of countries which are in big trouble facing sovereign debt crises. Now, that distinction kind of works, but at the same time, there are huge differences between the different crises within the periphery. And actually, this is a kind of quirky Venn diagram that is not mine, actually, and I would attribute it to somebody, but the person who's responsible for this said, don't mention my name, so I'm not going to. But this is not my work, but it's a neat way of illustrating some of the differences between the crises. And I think regarding the countries that I'm going to talk about, the interesting thing to note there is that Italy's problem is primarily a debt problem, and its banking system currently doesn't look too stressed by European standards, and its deficit isn't too bad either. Spain is in a different position because Spain doesn't have a big debt problem yet, although it's brewing very quickly, obviously, but Spain does have a big deficit problem and a banking problem. And of course, you see Ireland having primarily a banking problem and so on. I'm not going to go into much detail about what all that implies. The point I want to make, though, is that the crises, although they have a lot of things in common, such as big spreads on bonds compared to Germany, there are a lot of differences between them. And I'm going to try and lever these differences to make some claims about what's going on. Okay, so what is the puzzle? The puzzle is, that in the euro crisis, as Andy Moravshik said in a talk at Harvard last week, which I didn't attend, but I watched on YouTube. The link is there. If anyone's interested, you could grab it. A really great debate. A number of important scholars, Peter Hall, Torben Iversen, Moravshik, and so on, have been talking about the euro crisis. Really worth a view. And Moravshik's claim is that when you have a hammer, everything is a nail, and that is the way European elites are dealing with the crisis. And they have two preferred policy tools, as we know, controlling budgets, government budgets, and supply-side reforms. There is a big problem with this, which is that actually those are not necessarily addressing the nature of the problem. So the depth of crisis in European countries is not necessarily predicted by their budget deficits. Italy's is not that bad. Spain's is terrible, obviously. Or indeed by supply-side measures, because a lot of these countries actually did carry out a lot of supply-side reforms over the last few years. So And just to kind of, I won't spend too much time on these charts because this is a kind of, it's just to kind of show you that I'm not making this up. There is some data behind it. Spain had a much better budget balance than Germany before the crisis. Italy is, isn't desperately worse than Germany's either. So this is not really about budgets. I think this is kind of well established about, amongst people who've thought about the issues. And that the real problem is actually a problem of current account imbalances, which is that, you know, Northern Europe is running a big, has been running a big trade surplus and exporting capital to the south, creating an unsustainable boom up to the crisis point, and then, of course, the capital runs away and returns home again. So we have to actually identify what the problems are, and the problems are related to the ways in which these trade imbalances and capital flows have affected these different countries. So what I'm trying to do really in the paper is have a closer look at the standard narrative about how the financial crisis has affected Southern Europe and how we've ended up in this scenario of a sort of sovereign debt crisis that's threatening the euro as a currency. But also to address differences between Spain and Italy, which are very often bundled together, but which are actually very different kinds of political economies. So despite being both in this category of the pigs, they are obviously very, very different in a lot of ways. And the differences I'm really most interested in are the differences in the process of liberalization of economic institutions that have been taking place in these two countries over the last couple of decades. And the conclusion I'm going to draw is that actually the hope that among some policy elite in Europe, and particularly in Northern Europe, that structural reform would be the sort of sudden side of a quid pro quo to resolve the euro crisis, that you do structural reforms and in return we'll bail you out, actually is not going to work, because structural reform probably doesn't change anything very much, or at least not substantially enough to make a big difference. So, what is the standard narrative about what happened in Southern Europe? Of course, there are a variety of standard narratives, but you know, the common story is that these economies are overregulated. They are tend to be quite protectionist, both regarding protecting the national economy from competition from outside, but also within the national economy, different sectors have been very successful in arranging protectionist institutions to gain rents, and cronyism and corruption are concepts are often wheeled out as well. And I'm not suggesting that all of this is wrong, that these things are not a problem, but the standard account places a huge emphasis on the institutional failures, if you like, of these economies and explain the crisis. These countries also have a historical tendency to high inflation, and they have the wrong kinds of wage bargaining institutions. And again, this is not wrong. This is an important part of the story. These are countries which don't have the kind of corporatist regimes that worked well in Northern Europe in keeping wage costs down and making Germany and other countries in the north more competitive. Instead, they have unions that are strong enough to create inflation, but without being strong enough to deliver wage moderation. So the story would be that these countries have to make reforms in order to be able to survive in the euro area, and by making reforms, they would be able to make things work. So there is some evidence for the standard account. I'm not saying that all these things are wrong. I'm not even saying that all these things were not important in triggering the crisis. It's true that Southern European political economies are characterized by high levels of regulation across the economy compared to most other OECD countries, and there is also plenty of evidence of corruption. There's plenty of evidence of inefficient institutions and rent-seeking. And again, I won't spend too much time on this graph because there's not really time to go into detailed data points, but you know, one way of, you know, I what I did here is a factor analysis of different variables measuring regulation of different markets in domestic economies in OECD countries, and what you end up with is this kind of ladder going from the least regulated advanced economies, New Zealand, Denmark, USA, Canada, UK, which you would kind of expect, all the way up to the very regulated OECD countries, which are Greece, Portugal, Mexico, Turkey, Poland, Italy, Spain. So amongst the countries that are in the Eurozone, you can see that the countries that are in the deepest crisis are the very heavily regulated economies, with, of course, one huge exception, which is Ireland. And that kind of seems to suggest that the best place to be to survive the euro crisis is actually somewhere in the middle, rather than being in a deregulated, at the deregulated end of the table. So This creates a bit of trouble for the standard account and the standard remedy proposed by those who make that argument, that the real problem in Southern Europe is that overregulated financial product and labour markets distort allocation resources and make structural adjustment difficult. This narrative continues to argue that in currency union, you know, if you can't have effective corporatist institutions that deliver wage restraint, then what you've got to really do is eliminate the trade unions and deregulate the labour market as much as possible in order to keep wage costs down. The problem with all of that is that if you start to look in detail at the cases, and if you compare different cases like Spain and Italy, you start to see, pick up the nuances, that there are, you know, elements of the standard narrative that don't really work particularly well across the cases. So, first of all, you know, to come back to the Venn diagram I showed before, these countries have not all had the same kind of crisis. So the current account deficit, the trade imbalance, whereby southern countries started to import far more than they exported and were paying for it with flows of capital from the export surpluses of the north, sort of works pretty well for Spain and Greece, especially in the last few years before the crisis. Works quite well for Portugal, but it doesn't really work for Italy. Italy did not run a massive current account deficit. Italy has had competitiveness problems. The economy has been declining for 20 years, but its current account deficit was not that big. Not necessarily because its exports were doing so crazily well, but largely because Italians were not overspending. There was no credit boom in Italy, unlike in Spain, obviously. Similarly, the fiscal deficit, I won't go into too much detail about that, but again, you know, it isn't obvious that the countries that are in trouble now are the countries that had the biggest deficits. That's clearly not true. But the other side of the story is that this argument about structural reform, that this is the answer to resolving, you know, the imbalances that have developed in the Eurozone, runs into an empirical obstacle, which is that actually Southern European countries have already done a lot of structural reform. So this notion that actually Southern Europe has not changed anything very much, that it didn't make reforms in order to enter the Eurozone, is wrong. There's actually quite a lot has happened in Southern European political economies over the last couple of decades in particular, but also through the 70s and 80s, all kinds of reforms, and nearly all of these reforms in a liberalising direction. In other words, in a direction of converging with the patterns of economic institutions in the Northern European core. So this notion that these countries are too different to work within the Eurozone, well, clearly there are difficulties, but the idea that no effort has been made to push for institutional convergence is not true. There's been lots of labour market reform in both Spain and Italy. So yes, it's true that for some workers there is very heavy regulatory protection from being fired, but for most workers actually that is no longer the case, especially in Spain. And also the financial sector has been very heavily liberalised. Obviously capital controls were removed, that's a European requirement. But, you know, even above and beyond European requirements, there were lots of changes made. Banks that were under political control were largely privatised and so on. So there's been a lot of liberalisation, but it hasn't prevented this crisis from developing. And if we look at the comparison between the two cases, this seems to confirm that liberalisation isn't necessarily negatively correlated with crisis, right? So when it comes to the regulation variables, on the whole, Spain performs better than Italy. But if we're going to look at these two countries at the moment, Spain looks to be in the deepest trouble. So Spain has a more liberalised financial sector. Its financial sector is much more open, much more integrated into the world financial system, which, of course, ends up being a problem in the current climate. Spain also had twice as much foreign direct investment than Italy did before the crisis. So in a way, Spain was, although it was much criticised by the Lisbon scorecards, for example, measuring structural reform through the 2000s, it was criticised along with Italy and Greece and Portugal. But, you know, amongst that group of southern countries, Spain was the one regarded as having taken the most steps to modernise and liberalise its economy and integrate into, you know, thrusting global capitalism. And, you know, the biggest proof of that, of course, is having a good old-fashioned credit boom and housing bubble, which Spain did on a massive scale which matches anything that happened in Ireland or in the UK. And Italy didn't. Italy didn't have any kind of housing boom. House prices went up, but they also went up in France, they also went up in Denmark, they went up in lots of places. But there was nowhere near the kind of unsustainable credit boom. And so, you know, the Italian financial system, although the formal regulations don't necessarily look less liberal than the case in Spain, it just seemed that the way in which financial institutions in Italy work is much more oriented towards a kind of quite old-fashioned kind of national capitalism of quite close ties to strategic national industries and less interested in buying up utilities in Latin America, for example. So, and there's some data of financial regulation. If anyone wants to look further at that, you're welcome to, but afterwards. Okay, so now all of this matters quite a lot because the key part of the story really, I mean, it seems to be, from the people whose analysis I trust on this, it seems to have emerged that there is a consensus that the real cause of the real trigger of the crisis is that the imbalances in growth rates and inflation rates between southern and northern European economies developed into a trade imbalance and a shifting of capital from north to south in search of yield. And this was deeply destabilizing. And in this respect, what's happened in southern Europe looks very similar to other financial crises that we've seen in developing countries, in Asia in the 90s, in Mexico and Argentina in the 80s and 90s, and so on. So you get at this sort of abrupt flow of capital leads to overinvestment, bubble dynamics, and then, of course, the sudden stop and reversal. And my argument is that structural reform really offered no protection against this happening within the Eurozone. There are no capital controls. There's nothing that southern European countries could do to stop that capital flowing into the country. And the structural reforms probably would have done nothing. If there had been more structural reform, can we really argue that these capital flows would have been less destabilizing? Certainly the case of Ireland doesn't offer as much hope for this. And, you know, I did a quick Google to find, you know, I thought there must be a paper out there from about 2007 saying Ireland is in great shape and they're doing all the right things. And of course, you know, we know what happened next, and I found it. And George Mason University proudly presents us this paper on how the more economic freedom, in other words, the more liberalisation you get, the more successful an economy is. And Ireland is the proof of that. So the point is that if Spain had done what Ireland did, would it have saved it from the crisis? Almost certainly not. So how long have I got now? Am I doing okay?
2 minutes.
2 minutes, right. That's all I need to say that Spain is in much worse trouble than Italy. Okay, so sorry for the Spaniards out there. I guess you know that already. Not to say that things are looking so great in Italy. They're clearly not. But the effect of the crisis on Spain was much more severe because Spain had been growing quite fast. Actually, I think after Ireland, the fastest growing EU country between the Maastricht Treaty and the crisis was Greece, but Spain wasn't too far behind. So these countries had quite high growth rates, which we now realise was a function of these capital flows and the credit bubble that results, which of course feeds on itself as more people think, wow, Spain's growing really fast, and I think they liberalised a couple of things, so I must put my money in there because they're clearly going places. And in Spain, the effect of the crisis is to reverse that, right? So you have a negative feedback, so the capital flows away and you get this huge increase in unemployment, which was high enough to begin with, but full employment in Spain is about 8%, so 25% unemployment is clearly a big problem. Now, Italy suffered a heavy contraction as well in the crisis, but the employment performance was much better the destabilizing effect of the crisis is less of it. So essentially what I'm arguing is that the performance of these countries in structural reform terms seems to be a mirror image of the depth of the crisis. So what does all this mean in a minute and a half? Well, maybe crony capitalism has something to be said for it, to the extent that the kind of institutions usually denigrated as being corrupt and cronyistic can also offer protection from destabilizing capital movements, because one of the reasons why capital didn't flow into Italy so heavily as in Spain is that many investors didn't trust Italian institutions, which turned out to have been in some ways a good thing. So partial liberalization, so liberalization but the inability to develop the right kinds of institutions to work within the Eurozone, exposed Spain to bubble-driven growth. Now, just a couple of final points about where this leaves these countries and what the reform agenda is likely to look Like, we know that the EU is going to press for reforms, and they're going to press for labour market reforms in particular, and they're going to press for removing the things like the Article 18 in Italy, which gives certain kinds of workers reinstatement rights and against unfair dismissal and so on. That is always all going to keep being pushed. But the problem is that domestically, in terms of the domestic politics of these countries, many parties and voters on the left perceive that there has been structural reform and there was a terrible crisis. So why would we expect further structural reform, further liberalisation to improve things, especially since liberalisation means moving towards a more of an Anglo-Saxon kind of model, which we know performed just as badly in the crisis as the Southern European model. So it's very difficult to justify this politically. Also, the structural reform agenda is being coupled with the austerity agenda, deliberately so, as part of this deal between North and South. But of course, that's not going to help it in terms of its political legitimacy. Austerity, obviously enough, isn't popular. If you say that the companion of austerity is reform, it doesn't help reform in terms of overcoming domestic obstacles. And, you know, the kinds of political movements that we're seeing arising in Italy, a secessionist movement in Catalonia, the sort of populist Five Stars movement in Italy and so on, suggest that, you know, the kind of reactions coming out of this are not exactly conducive to reform leading to further liberalisation. So my final point would be that, you know, the only way out of this is for political parties to be capable of taking care of the adjustment and managing the redistributive effects of whatever adjustments end up being made. But the kinds of mainstream broad-based political parties that can do this are exactly the ones who are suffering in this crisis. They're being almost wiped out by the effects of austerity, so it's going to be very difficult actually to move to any of the kind of reforms that EU policymakers and German government officials seem to dream of. And at that depressing point, I will close.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Our second speaker today is Professor Eddie Ashby. He's an associate professor at the Department of Business and Politics at Copenhagen Business School. He has worked for the University of Southampton, Nottingham Trent University, and the Open University in the UK. He has written extensively about U.S. political processes, elections, interest groups, and public opinion.
Okay, yeah, I probably will.
Professor Ashby's work concentrates on the political economy and economics policymaking in both the U.S. and Britain. He is looking at the reactions to the economic crisis in both countries and writing a comparative study of the Anglo-Saxon model and the liberal market economies. And so he'll obviously dovetail nicely with Professor Hopkins' previous speech. So with that, we'd like to welcome Professor Ashby. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that introduction. As Stephanie said, I'm here to provide the American perspective, so I'll talk with blithe self-confidence as if the rest of the world doesn't exist. And I'm going to concentrate more on the way the crisis, the policy responses to the crisis, and the ways in which the crisis reconfigured the political landscape. So I'm going to emphasise politics as much as economics. I suppose the best starting point, at least it's as good as any, is to take that phrase much beloved by the humanities, which is American exceptionalism. A phrase that I don't myself use, but nonetheless, despite my distaste for the phrase, there are significant differences in terms of policy responses between the US and Europe. In particular, first of all, if we look at the scale of the fiscal stimulus measures, if we take the so-called Bush stimulus at the beginning of 2008, together with the so-called Obama stimulus February 2009, if we add them together and we look at them in relationship to 2008 GDP, we are talking about something very sizable indeed. Secondly, for very obvious reasons, there was much less of a reliance on automatic stabilisers than we see in the European nations. Now, the obvious way of developing that is to say, well, the US doesn't have those automatic stabilisers. But we should add one caveat. And that caveat is that although we often talk about the US having a small welfare state, you could well argue that the US has quite a large welfare state. It's just that that welfare state, as Christopher Howard has argued, is geared through tax credits and tax concessions rather than through direct expenditure programmes. The problem is, though, if you've got a welfare state structured around tax concessions and tax credits rather than direct expenditure programmes, it means often those tax credits and tax concessions are going to those constituencies that have significant political leverage. It is not working to providing the kind of cushioning or the degree of cushioning that expenditure programmes can provide at times of crisis. The third contrast I draw out is that a significant proportion of the stimulus spending was based around expenditure rather than tax concessions. Now, it's worth at this point drawing on the distinction that Jonas Pontersson has drawn in a recent study between what he calls liberal Keynesian responses and what he calls social Keynesian responses. By liberal Keynesianism, he's talking about relatively short-term responses to crises based around tax cuts, quantitative easing, a lack of enthusiasm for some of the things that were seen in earlier decades, a lack of enthusiasm for industrial policy or devaluation or overt forms of protectionism. Now, if we look at what's going on at the moment and what has gone on over the last 5 years, as Pontersson rightly argues, we see, first of all, more uniformity, less difference between countries in terms of policy responses, and those policy responses are geared towards the liberal end of the liberal social Keynesian continuum. But having said that, although the US is clearly within the liberal end of that continuum, the US response has more social components than some of the responses in other countries, particularly if we don't just take into account the reliance on expenditure programs, but we also take into account the bailout of the automobile industry or parts of the automobile industry. Fourth contrast I draw out is that, in contrast, of course, with many other countries, the crisis taken together with the November 2008 election opened the way for significant structural reforms, taking up some of the issues, most obviously healthcare reform, that had been on the progressive left's agenda for a long period. Fifthly, the crisis in the States gave rise to a large-scale counter-movement in the shape of the Tea Party movement as a protest not against austerity, but a protest against perceptions of big government. And we can well argue maybe it wasn't a genuine movement as such. I think former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi referred to it as AstroTurf, insofar as it had all sorts of wealthy backers. But nonetheless, it clearly had, insofar as anything could be called authentic, an authentic element to it. And that movement had significant consequences for the ways in which Republican legislators handled themselves on Capitol Hill. Sixthly, despite that counter-movement and the hostility of that counter-movement towards big government and government spending, austerity programs have, compared with many other countries, of course, been fairly limited, or limited at federal level. If we look at... If we look at what's been going on at federal level, obviously a lot of the decisions have been postponed. Policymakers all politely greeted the report of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, but nonetheless have so far largely failed to put any of its proposals into action. So whereas we've seen significant austerity measures at state level, brought about because you've got a commitment to balance budgets, either in the state constitution or alternatively in state statutes, if we look at federal level, we are waiting for the fiscal cliff, or if you're to believe recent commentaries, the fiscal slope, or indeed fiscal elevator, which will take shape over the coming months. We might also note, by way of a contrast, that of course the left, if we take the Democrats as the representatives of the left, the left has done significantly better than the left in many European countries. It's tempting to attribute much of the recent election earlier in the month to the deficiencies of the Republican candidate, which of course were many, or the deficiencies of certain Republican Senate candidates, which again of course were many. But it is clear that that election result was of particular significance. Mitt Romney, in fact, ran ahead of his party in a significant number of states. He wasn't a drag on the ticket. And really, the only reason, or one of the major reasons, the Republicans kept control of the House of Representatives is that their victories 2 years ago, their victories in 2010, because of the way things work at state level, allowed them to draw the electoral map in ways that assisted them in gaining victories this time around. Now, those, I think, are the major contrasts that we want to draw out between the US and many of the countries in Europe. Contrasts in terms of the nature of the economic policy responses that were put forward, and then some significant differences in terms of the way in which the crisis has over the years reconfigured the political landscape. Now, having said that, I don't want to overstate my case. Clearly, the major reforms that were passed, working backwards, Dodd-Frank, the reform of the financial sector, the Affordable Care Act, the Health Care Reform Act, and then the fiscal stimulus, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of February 2009, clearly these were major policy accomplishments in a political system that isn't particularly good at delivering major policy accomplishments. But nonetheless, we need to contextualise them. I mean, if we draw on the language associated with historical institutionalism and the approaches drawn from historical institutionalism, we are in large part talking about institutional extension rather than institutional change. A lot of these reforms are testimony to the resilience of path dependency. So if we look, for example, at the Affordable Care Act, healthcare reform, much of it is building on the existing structure of insurance, health insurance being provided by employers or individually or through Medicare or through Medicaid. Now we're adding to that through, for example, the individual mandate requiring people to have health insurance, but we are not changing the structures of provision and delivery. If we look in detail at the Recovery Act, the fiscal stimulus, much of that is bolstering state and local governments because of the fiscal dilemmas they faced at that particular time, and the elements that were committed to long-term economic restructuring through, for example, provision for the alternative energy sector were relatively limited. And if we look at Dodd-Frank, in many ways the jury's still out on large parts of it, but so far as we can tell, the basic defining features, or many of the basic defining features, of the financial sector remain in place. Certainly if we look at the basis on which Moody's awards its ratings, it is still making the assumption that many of those banks are too big to fail. Now, it could of course be argued, in fairness, that these measures, okay, they didn't immediately present radical changes, but nonetheless, maybe there are elements that within them that will over time lead to change. After all, if we look at many of the policy developments that have been attributed to neoliberalism over the last 20 or 30 years, neoliberalism hasn't engaged in a full frontal assault on existing institutional structures. When it has tried full frontal assaults, generally it's had to retreat, generally it's had to backtrack. Instead, generally what neoliberalism has done is to go in for what's often termed in the trade layering and drift. So if we look, for example, at social security provision, Instead of a frontal assault on social security provision for senior citizens, what we've had instead of a frontal assault is the development of private alternatives, 401ks, individual retirement accounts, that many on the right hope will eventually erode what we see erode public provision. Now, it's worth saying, have the reforms passed during the Obama years, have they contained elements that may lead to change over time? Now, I would argue that, in fact, in many cases, those reforms that have been passed have been stripped of components that would, over time, lead to change. If we look, for example, at the fiscal stimulus, as I indicated before, although there was funding that some have made much of, although there's funding for alternative energy, for example, it's relatively small. It's probably funding that's going to disappear in the fiscal cliff negotiations, and it doesn't provide much of a basis for future development. If we look at healthcare reform, what we see is, although there were plans at one stage for it to include a so-called public option, whereby public provision would compete with private insurance providers, that reform was dropped at a fairly early stage of deliberations. So what I'm arguing is, if we look at it, first of all, in terms of straightforward change, the changes that have come about are relatively limited. We need to set them in context. And secondly, even if we try and discern elements within them that may lead to longer-term change, we can't really find them, although obviously there are a whole series of known unknowns at this stage. It's worth asking, finally, why have the responses to the crisis been relatively limited? Why didn't they go further? After all, there seemed to be, at the peak of the crisis, at the beginning of 2009, when the Obama administration first took office, there seemed to be a moment of contingency, a moment of opportunity when much could be done. The words of Rahm Emanuel, the incoming White House Chief of Staff, have been widely quoted, sounding a bit like something out of The Sopranos, when he said, "You never want a serious crisis to go to waste. Things that we postponed for too long, that were long-term, are now immediate and must be dealt with. This crisis provides the opportunity for us to do things that you could not do before." And yet, despite that apparent moment of contingency that Rahm Emanuel highlights so neatly, relatively little, I'm trying to suggest, has come out in terms of institutional change. A lot has come out in terms of institutional extension, but not institutional change. So what I want to do finally is say, why is that? Now, part of the reason is obvious. It's the familiar stuff of US politics textbooks. It's the degree of fragmentation, the overwhelming number of veto points in the US system, the political limits, the extent to which perhaps Obama was co-opted by the Bush administration during the final months before he took office, during the peak of the financial crisis itself, and was co-opted in particular into the Bush administration's Wall Street First efforts. Also, the advisors he was surrounded by after he ditched his first initial round of advisors during the campaign and had turned to those who'd been involved at the highest levels in the Clinton administration. So we can point to all that, but I want to suggest that we should also think about broader institutional variables. We need to think, particularly if we're drawing comparisons between the Great Recession and the Great Depression, about the degree of institutional cluttering, the constituencies, the groups that reform was up against. Senior citizens, who, for example, are the main beneficiaries of Medicare, fearful of reform and fearful that an extension of healthcare would make their own healthcare provision rather worse and weaker. Secondly, that cluttering of the institutional landscape in the US has particular importance because of what might be called the porousness of the American state, its openness, the ability of different groups and well-positioned and well-leveraged groupings to get in there and veto particular measures. We should also think about issues of timing and sequencing, particularly if we're drawing comparisons between the Great Recession and Great Depression. Roosevelt, of course, only coming to office 4 years after the Wall Street crash. Very different timing and sequencing this time around. And finally, we probably need to consider the nature of the Obama coalition and draw some contrasts and comparisons with the Roosevelt coalition of the 1930s and 1940s. Clearly, the historians disagree about the Roosevelt coalition. Just how much support did it get from at least fractions, groupings within the business community when it embarked upon the New Deal? If we're to believe Thomas Ferguson, who talks in terms of an investment theory of party competition, then significant sections of business, particularly capital-intensive business, were backing the New Deal reforms. What's clear, though, if we look at the Obama coalition, although, as we know only too well, it's got levels of support and levels of turnout that I certainly didn't expect a second time around from young people, from minorities, the Obama administration has done very badly from about mid-2009 onwards in terms of securing support within the business community. Even new technology, which was the Obama campaign's main business supporter in 2008, even new technology, if the comments of the late Steve Jobs are to be believed, if the pattern of financial contributions is to believe, even new technology has turned against the Obama coalition, the Obama administration. And Obama won earlier this month in spite of the business community and not because of a section, because of support from a section of it. And I think that raises a general point that we may want to return to later in the day. How far can major structural reform succeed if it is not backed by at least some fraction within the business elites? And on that note, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Eddie. Our next speaker is Professor George Philip. He's a professor of comparative and Latin American politics at the LSE. Professor Philip did his BA at Oxford, where he graduated in philosophy, politics, and economics. And then he did his doctorate at Nuffield College, Oxford. After a year as a research fellow at the Institute of Latin American Studies in London, he joined the LSE in 1976. He recently published a book on Mexico's struggle for public security and has a unique perspective to bring to today's topic of domestic politics in crisis.
Thank you. I'll sit if I may. You can hear me at the back. Okay, I'll try and check. I'm by profession a Latin Americanist, and for a Latin Americanist to look at financial crises is a little bit like a coal merchant looking at Newcastle. We invented them, we've had more than anybody else, and when it appears that other countries are catching up with Latin America in terms of their proclivity for crisis, we have another one or something different happens to give us back our position in pole position. So when I was asked to talk about financial crisis in Latin America, I had quite a lot of choices, cases to choose between. And I chose to look at three. One was Mexico in 1982. 1982 was a year when everything went wrong in Latin America. It started with some degree of economic growth and a problem with financial solvency. By the end of the year, it was in the middle of a recession which was sufficiently serious to invite comparison with the 1930s. Then I looked at Mexico in 1994, where the so-called tequila crisis nearly brought down the entire international financial system and was surprisingly quickly resolved from a Mexican point of view. But tequila is certainly a shorthand for a major financial crisis based on exchange rate difficulties and over-indebtedness. And third, I looked at Venezuela in 1994, where a crisis in the bankruptcy of the Banco Latino nearly brought down the entire Venezuelan banking system and put an end to the Venezuelan government's not very determined efforts to try to adopt Washington consensus neoliberal policies. The Banco Latino crisis really put an end to that and changed the way in which the country was governed. So if you look at the outcome of those crises, you'll see that Mexico has adopted pretty much market-oriented principles. It's integrated economically with the United States, it's a member of NAFTA, it's a major exporter of manufacturing goods, and it's adopted pretty much what the international financial orthodoxy required it to do. If you look at what Venezuela reacted to the crisis, the answer is they voted for Chavez at the first opportunity in 1998, and Chavez, as everybody knows, is not a Washington consensus man. He's a radical nationalist who has so far maintained popularity by flouting market principles, insulting the President of the United States every opportunity, and generally making himself famous for reasons that the Washington consensus would disapprove of. So you've got crises in different countries. They're similar in different cases, but their outcomes were almost totally different. And the question I ask is, why did relatively similar economies faced with relatively similar crises come result them in such very different ways? And it seems to me that what we have to do is to look at the way in which crises affect the political system in the various countries. And the first point to make is that what happens when you have a crisis is people look for someone to blame. They look for, crises are obviously unwelcome, so there must be somebody's fault, and somebody or other is looked at as being responsible for the outcome, and therefore should be discredited politically and so on. Institutions do sort of matter, but they don't matter as much as a kind of cultural mentality, in the sense that crises and the issue of a culture of blame have to do with arguments and certainly different interpretations of these events. And the different interpretations are partly a matter of science, partly a matter of logic and academic style argument, but they're also partly a matter of power. And on the whole, the best placed people to win debates are those who are in positions of power, and they're the ones that tend to win them. So on the other hand, I wouldn't go to the other extreme of saying that it's all a matter of political power, because argument does matter, and the logic of different arguments does make a difference to the way in which people perceive events in the future. What I would look at is something in the way to call a cultural mentality, in which people have a predefinition to believe certain things, but are prepared to argue them out and sometimes change their minds if there are differences of viewpoint expressed with particular cogency. We can look at this in practice in Mexico in 1982, when there was a severe problem leading to a major public debate in what who was to blame for the outcome of the disastrous outcome. Now, the president at the time, José López Portillo, was a man who had some trouble making up his mind between different courses of action, but he was mainly a nationalist. And in 1982, he nationalized the banks, imposed exchange controls, forced Mexicans with money in dollars to accept pesos in return for their dollars at a lower rate, negotiated, albeit not to a conclusion, some kind of debtors' cartel. And towards the end of the period of office, he was quite radical and left-wing in his way. And he blames the crisis on an irresponsible financial elite. He thought that the problem with the Mexican economy was that you had bankers and other wealth holders whose real aim in life was to speculate against the Mexican peso, and who were aimed to challenge the legitimate authority of the president of the day. And so when he nationalized the banking system, he said it was a matter of national sovereignty and national pride to do so. He was replaced in power fairly shortly after the drama by President Miguel de la Madrid, who was an economic liberal, and he blamed fiscal populism for the debacle, and essentially was an economically orthodox figure. His policies were pretty much determined by the IMF, the World Bank, the Washington Consensus generally, although it wasn't called that, in the 1980s. Then you had academics who blamed presidentialism and said you have too much power without responsibility. In Mexico you have what Vargas Llosa was later to describe as a perfect dictatorship. You had too much power given to too few people, and they were therefore liable to behave irresponsibly in the Actonian sense of all power turning to corruption, absolute power corrupting absolutely. So the critique of presidentialism was more an academic critique than a power political one, but it had quite a significant long-term effect on Mexican politics. Mexico, having had one of the strongest presidential systems in the world, now has one of the weaker ones, with all kinds of things that presidents can't do, and the presidency as an institution is now scarcely more powerful than that of the United States, for example. Then Newell and Rubio, also academics, but from a different stable, said the problem with Mexico was that they didn't have a democracy. If you had a democracy, you would have checks and balances. And what you had instead of democracy was populism, was presidents trying to please the powerful and try to please people who were frustrated by the absence of democracy by adopting unsound fiscally and monetary policies, which lead to crisis after their unsoundness had become obvious to markets. So Newell and Rubio argue that there was a kind of ensatz democracy which didn't have any virtues of the real institutional one, but did lead to crowd-pleasing politics, which didn't really work very well. And De La Madrid, I think, was the winner in that debate because he became president. He was nominated to the presidency before the worst of the crisis blew up. He succeeded López Portillo in a normal way and adopted ordinary macroeconomic policies. And when asked by a visiting correspondent what about his views were a democracy, he replied that Mexico wasn't ready for democracy. So the response, De La Madrid's response to the crisis was economic reform and not political reform at all. He partly lost control of the process at the end of his presidency and political reform kind of happened. But the Mexican authorities didn't go for political reform as a result of the crisis. They went for economic reform instead. And that was a controversial choice, which could have been made either way, according to who won the political debate. In 1994, after some years of economic improvements and some years of optimism, Mexico underwent another economic crisis, the so-called tequila crisis, when a bungled devaluation led to a massive roll in the peso, which in turn led to the near insolvency of Mexico's banking system. And it required America to come in with $20 billion of reserves to enable Mexico to survive without a further default of some kind or crisis of some kind or another. And Zedillo's choice of who to blame was the exchange rate. Mexico had adopted a crawling peg system which was vulnerable to events and vulnerable to political crises or political problems which are by definition unpredictable and no one can foresee. And 1994 was a bad year in Mexico for crisis. You had the Zapatista rising in January. You had the murder of the presidential candidate Donaldo Colosio in March. You had the murder of a senior figure in the PRI later in the autumn. And people were wondering what was going on and who was going to be murdered next. And the result was capital flight. The result of that was the depletion of government foreign exchange reserves. The result of that was the government chose. They hoped to manage devaluation, which became unmanaged. And the whole thing went down with a very large bang at the end of 1994. But the tendency to blame foreign exchange policies was rather a technical concern. and most Mexicans didn't blame the government's economic policy making so much as corruption within the political system. There was plenty of evidence that there was lots of corruption in the political system, so the blaming was not by any means unreasonable, but it did have the effect of discrediting the outgoing president of Mexico, Carlos Salinas, and encouraging and giving sufficient breathing space to the incoming president of Mexico, Ernesto Zedillo, who was therefore able to solve the problems in a slow... in a gradual but effective way. And there has not been another major fiscal crisis in Mexico since 1994. Venezuela responded differently to its crisis. Essentially, it blamed the system of corruption, which was certainly a not unreasonable thing to blame for the bank failure of the Banco Latino. The Banco Latino was notoriously fly in its financial arrangements and relied on political contacts rather than good banking principles to prosper in the political climate of the day. And as a result of that, when the political climate turned adverse, the bank went down. And in their efforts to protect the banking system as a whole, or rather to protect depositors as a whole, the authorities ended up with an inflationary response to the public crisis, which in turn discredited the government and paved the way for Chavez's successful electoral candidacy in 1998. So why was the response of the crisis in Venezuela so different? Well, one reason was oil. Venezuelans are aware that they have oil. They're a big oil exporting country, as everybody knows. And the popular expectation is that oil money will make you rich, will make Venezuelans rich. When it doesn't make them rich, they tend to look for scapegoats or look for people to blame. And the people they tend to blame are the corrupt politicians of the day. There was not much technical analysis of what went wrong because, again, when you have a bank crisis, it's a thoroughly emotional political experience. And in any event, I'm not sure the government really understood the consequences of its own policies in that respect. But they did have the consequence of discrediting the political system significantly. Now, why again would there be so much difference between the politics of responding to the crisis in Mexico and the one in Venezuela? Oil, yes, but that's not quite the whole explanation. I would argue that the Mexican state was built around the issue of social control for reasons that go back to the turn of the 20th century and the revolution in Mexico. The revolution in Mexico achieved lots of positive things, but it did have the effect of causing a lot of poverty and a lot of death. And the authorities, when they came to power in the 20s and 30s, decided to reify, praise the revolution effusively and make sure you didn't have another one. And as a consequence of that, Mexico built a lot of institutions around the need for social control, trade unions run by union boss mafia, the military run by people without much accountability, the official party which declared election results as its ill-fit, a repressive state apparatus which could deal with dissent if necessary quite ruthlessly. So the Mexican state was built around social control. And when there was a crisis, the authorities found it easier to find scapegoats, and the people tended to rally around the government and follow their diagnosis of the situation. The Venezuelan system, the so-called Punto Fijo system of democracy, was built around redistribution. It was the aim of what it did to avoid. Was a period of military government or a military coup or a political polarization that might lead to military coup, which was a serious threat in the 60s and 70s when democratically elected governments were toppling all over the region. And so the Punto Fijo system was aimed at being not so much geared to efficiency or control, but to something more in the reach of redistributing income and making sure everyone got a piece of the action. So history matters, institutional history matters too, but it's not the whole story. There will be debates between different groups and different individuals as to who to blame and what went wrong and why it should go right. And that will be partly a matter of resolution through the logical quality of what's being argued, as well as the power of those who are doing the adjudicating. On which note, I shall finish. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George. Our final speaker on the domestic politics panel today is Dr. David Woodruff. He's a senior lecturer in comparative politics at the LSE in the Department of Government. Dr. Woodruff studied Slavic languages and literature at Harvard College, and then he went to Berkeley for his MA and PhD. Prior to joining the LSE in 2006, Dr. Woodruff was an associate professor at MIT and a visiting associate professor at Harvard University. His work analyzes the politics of economics, of monetary and corporate property rights. Thanks.
Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here talking to this attractive and intelligent audience, and to be the last speaker, I will try to make my message very pithy for you. So here is the theory I'm going to be presenting today. Part of it is already familiar to you. What is the best thing about bashing your head against the wall? The answer, as I'm sure you all know, is that it feels very good when you stop. The second piece of my theory is that if somebody convinced you that bashing your head against the wall was a good idea, once you stop, you may be kind of mad at them. So I think if you put these two insights together, you can learn a lot about the politics and the political aftermath of financial crisis. And I'm going to be focusing on perhaps an exotic crisis, but one which I think has more general features, the exchange rate and financial crisis that took place in Russia in 1998. And here is the less tongue-in-cheek version of the argument that I'm going to present. Russia adopted in 1995 an exchange rate corridor very similar to the policy that Mexico had in the run-up to its 1994 crisis. That was a policy designed to be a form of constitutionalized neoliberalism. And what I mean by that, I will explain in a moment. And this constitutionalized neoliberalism, which locked in a certain set of policies, led to the stubborn pursuit of an institutionally unsustainable economic policy. And I'm going to define what I mean by institutionally unsustainable in a moment as well. One consequence of this institutionally unsustainable policy was that it led to artificial state weakness. It made the Russian state seem much weaker than it needed to be. Put the problems of the policy together with this artificial state weakness, and eventually you get the crisis of 1998 and the collapse of this unsustainable policy. And once the policy, this exchange rate policy, is taken away, it's like not bashing your head against the wall anymore, there's a rapid economic recovery and simultaneously a rapid recovery of state capacity. So the fact that they're no longer trying to run a policy that weakens state power means that you get the recovery and a rise in the capacity, especially the national state, at the same time. So if you take out the intermediate steps, what people see is that when you get rid of constitutionalized neoliberalism, and it goes beyond exchange rate policy, but that's just what I'm going to focus on here, if you get rid of that, you get rapid economic recovery and a rapid recovery of state capacity. And so it's not surprising that you get a kind of nationalist and étatiste political formulation that goes together with these things, which I call nationalist neo-statism, although I'm not necessarily entirely happy with that term. So that's where I'm going. That's the steps in the argument I'm going to be spelling out, and now I will try to concretize them. So what do I mean by constitutionalized neoliberalism? Well, constitutionalized neoliberalism is based on the idea that certain pro-market policies, such as maintaining low inflation rates, for instance, will regularly experience transitory political difficulties, that these policies are beneficial, but they will be unpopular for transitory reasons. And in order to ensure that they're not abandoned in the face of such short-term, short-sighted opposition, it's important to constrain policy, to tie policy to the mast, just as Ulysses tied himself to the mast to avoid the temptations of the sirens. Market liberal policies ought to be locked in some way to avoid the temptations of deviating from them. This has a positive impact, because once some sort of firm constitutional policy commitment has been made, it's hard to deviate from it, and economic actors will look at that and say, hey, that's a policy that's going to persist. That is a policy that if I'm thinking about investing, I can invest on that basis. If I'm a firm wondering, do I have to adjust to these harsh circumstances or maybe the government will relent, I will see, gee, this policy has been locked in. The government's not going to relent. I do need to adjust. Now, this metaphor of Ulysses and the mast and these market policies gets told over and over and over again. And one of the interesting things about it is that nobody seems to ever recall that it was not Ulysses who thought up this idea of tying himself to the mast. It was actually Circe, the nymph, and Circe was divine. And because she was divine, she had perfect foreknowledge of the things that were going to face Ulysses on his way home. So she knew that the problem was going to be the sirens and that tying himself to the mast was a good idea. If you're tied to the mast and your ship starts sinking, that's not such a good idea, right? So the idea behind constitutionalized neoliberalism is that the people designing it know what the right policy is going to be, because they've implicitly thought that Ulysses was mortal, and they're mortal too. They can do what Ulysses did, but Ulysses had divine backing, divine foreknowledge that is not accessible to the rest of us. And you might want to worry whether this metaphor is as useful as people make it out to be. And I think we can argue that it's not. So, in 1995, Russia instituted an exchange rate corridor, a crawling peg. And the idea was to make a firm commitment that the exchange rate would be within certain bands. And if this, once this commitment was made, it would be hard to back off of, and it would have the positive effects on expectations described in the preceding slide. And you'll see that Russia had very high inflation before the institution of the ruble corridor. Those are monthly inflation rates, not annual ones. And that it comes down quite a bit after the ruble corridor. So it does have a positive effect. However, this policy, making this policy work, required really extreme measures. One of the extreme measures was that they kept interest rates very, very high. Interest rates were very, very high, which attracted people who had money in dollars and other foreign currencies to invest in rubles, and so helped to maintain the interest rate peg. How high were the interest rates? These are real annual interest rates. The lowest they got over the whole period of the ruble corridor was about 18% a year, but for much of that period, they were well over 50%, touching over. The highest point they got to was almost 150%. It was 150% nominal. You'll see, starting in November of 1997, on this graph, real interest rates start going up. This is the Russian Central Bank reacting to the Asian crisis and saying, we're not going to devalue here. We'll keep our interest rates really high. We'll do whatever it takes. So trying to say, our commitment is really credible. We're not backing down. And one of the things you might want to think about is, why were they so stubborn in this policy? Why did they stick with this policy when it required these incredible interest rates? Well, part of the reason was that once a lot of investors had been induced to come in, to convert dollars into rubles, that was kind of like a doomsday machine, because if those, if that capital got the idea that the ruble would be devalued, it would go out very quickly. And so this was a kind of emergent tying policy to the mass, because it changed and changed the configuration of interest. A lot of those investors turned out to be well connected, and probably Russia held on in part as long as it did to give connected people a chance to unwind their position. Anyway, another aspect of this policy that was quite damaging is what's known as real appreciation. And all this means is that, as Dr. Hopkin was talking about earlier with the case, with respect to the case of Southern Europe, prices in Russia were going up faster than prices in the rest of the world and faster than the exchange rate was adjusting. So you, the blue line here is prices, the ruble, the red line is rubles per dollar. You'll see that prices were going up much faster than the exchange rate was adjusting until the very end there when they have the devaluation. I haven't tried to make the dollar real dollars, but you get the point. The point is that Russian industry, Russian exporters are becoming much less competitive. And this, by the way, was after a period of substantial real appreciation before the ruble corridor. So I'm going to argue that you put these policy features together and you get an institutionally unsustainable policy. In order to make that argument, I need to tell you what I mean by an institutionally unsustainable policy. Well, capitalism, as we know, is based on institutions that are defined in law. Property and contracts, certainly, but also money. We forget that money is a legal institution, but it is. On the U.S. currency, it says this debt is legal tender. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Money is what we pay to cancel a legal obligation. Any set of legal regulations, including legal regulations around money, only work if most of the people, most of the time, obey them or follow the relevant rules, mostly voluntarily. If, for some reason, a policy is adopted that pushes against voluntary compliance with the key economic institutions of capitalism, those institutions will stop functioning the way we're familiar with, and the state, which tries to make them function in that way, will look very weak. So that's what I mean by an institutionally unsustainable policy. I mean a policy that breaks down adherence to the fundamental legal institutions of capitalism. A state running such a policy will look weak, but it's only weak because it is trying to force the mass of business, the mass of people, to do things that they're not willing to do. And any state that tries to do that is going to look weak, much like a state that runs, you know, a prohibition of alcohol or the war on drugs, right? We think of corruption, we think of state weakness associated with these things, but those are relative to what the state is trying to achieve. So how come these very high interest rates, real appreciation, how did that pass into what I'm calling an institutionally unsustainable policy? Well, what happened, I have 7.5 minutes left to explain this to you, but I'm going to do my best to do it, that Russian businesses started using alternatives to the ruble to carry out their transactions. By the end of the ruble corridor, it's very hard to get a sense of, these things are very hard to measure, but between 50 and 70% of all transactions in Russian industry were being carried out either in some sort of barter arrangement where companies would swap goods, or in what were called debt offsets, which were essentially private monies. So the ruble, which was supposed to be the only way you could pay off a debt, lost its exclusive status. This happened through the following causal chain. The policies associated with the ruble corridor, the high interest rates, the growth catastrophe that Russia had experienced after the collapse of communism, the real appreciation, and also some institutional features of the Russian economy that meant that prices, it was very hard to adjust prices, led a lot of firms to accumulate unpayable debts, debts that they simply were not able to pay back. Now, you might say, well, if creditors can't get their debts paid back, they ought to turn to the courts, they ought to put their debtors into bankruptcy. But the problem with that policy is that if all you've got is debtors, you're a business, you're trying to sell things, but all you've got is debtors, taking them all to court is essentially killing all of your customers, which is not a very commercially sensible policy. So given that customers were running up unsustainable debts, sellers, creditors, tried to figure out ways that they could write down these debts, give companies something of a break. So you might have an electric power company that was owed money by a paint factory. And the paint factory says, our paint's not selling. We can't pay for our electricity. Would you like some paint? And the electric power company says, all right, well, we'll take some paint. And then they paint the electric power plant, and they've still got paint. What are they going to do next? And they go to the local government, and they say, you know, we owe you some taxes. We don't have any money, but we've got this paint. Would you like some paint? And so the local government says, okay, we'll take the paint, and we'll paint the schools, right? So you get this pathway from debt to barter. Now, barter is very inconvenient because not everybody wants paint, right? So people start to replace it with various kinds of money that represent the right to buy electricity or the right to pay local taxes. You get all of these surrogate currencies. These surrogate currencies are not worth as much as the ruble because if the people spending them had rubles to spend, they wouldn't have needed to use them in the first place. So in effect, what you've got are these alternative currencies which say on them that this is worth a ruble, but actually, they're worth a lot less. They're like little decentralized, devalued monies. So the national government is holding on to the exchange rate for dear life with these incredible interest rates and tolerating incredible real appreciation. And yet, there's a massive exit from the monetary system and the creation of decentralized, devalued alternatives. Now, this leads to what you might technically call a big fiscal mess, because how are you going to tax these things? Well, you could do what I did in the paint example, right, which is try to figure out how to use the direct goods, or maybe you take in these kind of IOUs of limited circulation, that these quasi-monies, and try to spend them. But it's very, very difficult to do. It's especially difficult for the federal government to do, and in that context, it's really remarkable that by 1997, 40% of federal taxation was collected in quasi-monies. It was probably around 60% at the local level. So what that meant was that a lot of the revenue base was shifting to the local level because the local level was much better at taxing these quasi-monies. So as a result, you get this constant problem of incredible budget deficits and incredible tax difficulties that Russia is encountering over this period. The IMF never really figures out what's going on and says things like, you must get rid of all of these things tomorrow. The last deal that Russia signed before it devalued literally said that, but that couldn't happen. Okay, so I'm running out of time a little bit. I'm going to say what happened after Russia backed off from this unsustainable policy without talking about the details of how it ended. What happened after Russia backed off is, first of all, you got a very rapid recovery. Russian firms, there was a huge devaluation. Russian firms that had looked not the least competitive before suddenly became competitive. There was a huge inflation, which wiped away a lot of the unsustainable debts that had given rise to the problem of barter and money surrogates. So those went away very quickly. Export became a much bigger share of the economy because exports were now more valuable. The federal government controlled export receipts, so it became much stronger. In general, there was a decisive shift to a stronger national state. And internationally, Russia had defaulted on its debt at the same time as it devalued, and now was able to take a very hard line with its creditors because it had nothing left to lose. The negotiator at the time was famous for saying no to everything the creditors proposed. And one famous incident, he said, no, I don't like any of this, but the font you're using is very nice. So the political consequences, then, that go together with this is you get a simultaneous recovery and a simultaneous strengthening of the state. And put those things together, and you see it maybe as not particularly surprising that Putin became as assertive as he did, that Putin, at least in some matters, took a policy line that was very hostile to neoliberalism, and certainly very hostile to what I called constitutionalized neoliberalism. So this banging your head against the wall, once you stop, you get particular political consequences. Russia was mad at the people who made it bang their head against the wall. All right, now I'm right at 20 minutes, but I'm going to spend one more. Is that all right? So I just want to ask how general this mechanism might be. I will just put the slide up there for a second to say that I think that it applies pretty well to the case of Argentina, but maybe it would be, which had a devaluation at the end of 2001, early 2002. It had also a huge problem of monetary surrogates, but I think it's particularly interesting to think about whether this sort of mechanism might have anything to do with the crisis in the Eurozone. I think it's quite obvious that the ECB and the creation of the euro is quite analogous, but an even tighter form of tying to the mast than Russia used. The question then is, will you get, suppose the euro collapses, or suppose there's a radical shift in eurozone policy towards a more inflationary policy, what will be the political formula associated with that? Well, I think you will see. I think you will see a rapid recovery. You will see states that seem to be able not to accomplish anything start to accomplish things, and I think that there could be some parallels. That's speculative, but I do think that there is at least a historical precedent for it. So let me stop there.
Thanks, Sam. So we have time for one or two questions, but of course we'll continue this discussion over lunch, and I'm sure any of the questions that you don't get a chance to ask the panelists, they'll be happy to talk about over lunch. So in the interest of time, could you please specify the panelists that you'd like to answer your question? Jonathan got off the hook easy by escaping, but any of the other panelists, please specify your questions too. So any questions? You're letting them all off too easy. Perhaps no one wants to be the one that's in between us and lunch. Yes, please.
Okay, I was not going to come in because actually my question was going to be for the speaker who's missing, but I just wanted to put something on the table and I can maybe get in touch with him. I mean, he made a couple of comments I don't quite agree with. One of them was that structural reforms are not going to change much at all. And I just don't agree with that, because structural reforms, from my point of view, would give you growth in the end, and that would help deal with the debt problem. I mean, you know, the problem on debt is debt GDP ratios are being very inflated, and you need to grow out of those debt GDP ratios and get back to a better position. So I don't agree. I'll get in touch with him about that. And the second point is that he was talking about the amount of structural reform in Spain vis-a-vis Italy. And I also don't agree with him on that. I think there's been very slow progress in structural reforms in both Spain and Italy. But what has happened is there's been an amazing acceleration during the crisis. And this has, of course, partly been because of the various discussions in the euro area about programs and so on, but there's been a pickup in structural reforms in European countries, which is really quite dramatic, and it's something that OECD has actually produced some analysis on. I mean, he did have some slides on product market indicators, which are ones that come from the OECD. If you remember the slide which had New Zealand and Denmark on the far left, and had Mexico, Turkey, and some other countries, Greece off on the far right, those come from the OECD. And if you look at those, look at a time series of those, you see that, in fact, there were very few structural reforms in Europe for a long period of time, but there's been an acceleration with the crisis. Whether that's going to solve this situation is another matter, of course. But so he may be right on some of his points about structural reforms not doing much for you in the short run, but certainly in the longer term it should do something.
If I could answer on Dr. Hopkins' behalf, I think that he might well invoke Keynes' famous statement on the longer term, being that in the long term we're all dead. And the you pointed out that there's been a very rapid acceleration of structural reform since the crisis, but there has not. The growth performance is really bad, and so the question, is whether this is relevant to resolving the crisis. And so I think, if I could put it in the framework of what I was saying, if you use a crisis like this to bash people over the head on unrelated matters, and in fact that is very much what the IMF did with Russia. It said, in this last deal that it put out before Russia devalued, it said, totally reform the labor market institutions. Russia said, okay, we want the money, right? It had nothing to do with the roots of the economic crisis. And I think politically that is a very difficult and dangerous formula. And that was the point that Dr. Hopkins was trying to make, that associating these things with austerity doesn't necessarily make them so popular.
Thanks. Time for one more quick question. I let you pick.
One word I don't think I've heard in any of the four presentations is the word corruption. And yet my perception of Russia, Venezuela, Mexico, Italy, and possibly less Spain, is that there's a great deal of corruption among political elites and the economic elites. To what extent has corruption caused these processes, and to what extent is it actually getting worse?
George, do you want to do that?
Yes, okay. I think you did hear me mention corruption in respect to the Banco Latino, because clearly corruption was a large part of the explanation for its failure. Corruption is an all-purpose target for politicians, whether there is any or not, and there's usually quite a bit. And I would be in agreement with you that it's probably becoming more of a problem rather than less. But alternative explanations to corruption have to do with mismanagement or the pursuit of mistaken economic doctrines or policies. And the Mexicans and the Venezuelans fell on opposite sides of that particular fence in terms of who to blame.
Thank you. So at this point, we're going to continue the conversation over lunch. Thank you to our panelists for their excellent presentations, very insightful and informative and provocative, perhaps. And thank you also for your attendance and your questions. Thanks.